This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back.
We're back. My headphones are very loud, Nick.
I've cranked the volume up to max. I've cranked it up to 11. That's what they say, isn't it?
It's probably good, isn't it? It's probably quite... It's rock and roll. Play at maximum volume.
If you are listening at home...
you're supposed to be playing this at maximum
this
volume.
This should be at maximum.
That's much better, thank you.
Be at
thank
maximum you, volume. This yeah. should be at max vol, is what I call it.
That's what I call a man called Mac.
Oh, man. Oh. It's 2 hours to fill.
We've got 2 hours.
We're doing 2 hours.
This is going to be twice as long.
Twice as grueling as usual.
If you like it usually, this is going to be twice as shambolic. More time to fill?
More time to fill. Less life to kill.
Yes.
That's my little phrase. Because by the end of it, you will be 2 hours closer to the grave.
And we might kill ourselves.
Although, if you're listening to it on iTunes, they take out all the songs. So it's only really 15 minutes of content.
Depends.
So it's absolutely fine.
Often we don't play many songs.
No, I know, but we might do. This is the most like an actual radio
show. Yeah, it is. It feels quite...
Don't talk over me. But I do enjoy your company. We're a minute in to the marathon. Now I know how Mark Watson feels. We've got so much time to fill. Oh, I got a bit of a frog in my throat.
So have I. This is not handy.
Oh, what I was saying to you earlier.
Hey, wait a minute.
What?
Who are we?
You are listening to Nick
and Nat's
fan club. My name is Nick.
And my name is Nat. And this is Fan Club. Together we are Fan Club.
We nailed it.
The first
rule of Fan Club.
Tell all your friends about Fan Club.
It's the first time we've done this. Yeah. Actually. Second rule of Fan Club is for the love of your God, whoever he or she might be.
How long have we got left?
We've got an hour and 58 minutes to go.
Jesus Christ.
So it's good. But what I was saying to you before was, this is exactly why we shouldn't talk to each other before we go on.
No, because you just basically do another, there's probably another 40 minutes a show.
We just talk about it. But then it looks
content.
It's really odd, you know, just sort of like meeting up and then just like
yeah.
Save it for the show, Nat. Save it for the show. But what I was saying was that the first time you do anything is really, you think that that's the first time we did an hour, we thought, I don't know how we're going to fill an hour. And then before long, we were skipping songs and, you know, we almost missed the game at least twice. And then you realise, actually, we can fill an hour. So this is the first time we're going to fill 2 hours. I said it was like going to the gym, but that's just me talking about the gym. That's me saying that I've been to the gym. I went to the gym this morning.
Did you? What do you do at the gym?
Today was upper body. It was.
So there's weights in that, is it?
Oh, yes.
Do you find the gym... I find it an intimidating place.
I have a personal trainer who I met. I told you I accidentally did a corporate video and I thought I was just making a short film and I met this guy. And I wouldn't do it if it wasn't for that. If it wasn't for... the fact that I'm in an empty gym with one guy who's just telling me to push harder.
I think that might help. Maybe that's what I need.
I think that's how I get through it. But I mean, if it's okay, but do you know what I mean?
If you walked in and you didn't have a trainer, you just had all the stuff in front of you, would you be there for like 10 minutes and then leave? Would you be like, oh, I've done that.
Well,
that'll do.
No, I don't know. I think I'd probably do the time. But what I'm more intimidated about is other people in the gym judging me. So I was bullied mercilessly at school when I was doing PE and stuff like that, and that put me off doing any sports. Like I won't go swimming in just my trunks, and so I haven't been swimming for like I would say maybe 20 years. I find my personal appearance physically disgusting. I'm disgusted with myself, and looking, I've probably got some form of body dysmorphia, right? So I look in the mirror and I don't like what I see, and so then I don't go to the gym and I don't go to the swimming bath and I don't do anything like that, and then you just realise what you're doing is you're making yourself at least unhealthier and at worst you're shortening your life just because of what some people said, you know, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So,
and is it like that at the gym? Is everyone there when you see them? Are they all?
I tell you what, fucking
good-looking people who are all very
So what happened today? Well, I had to tell him today because what happened today was I got there. We do an hour. I get there on time. He's always there on time. He listens to the show. He started listening to the show, so he stopped asking me about. hello, Kenny. He stopped asking me about what my life is up to, because he just gets all of that hit on the
So you just
podcast.
Sit in silence now.
Yeah, it's just me doing push-ups. So what happened today was we started at 8, and then it got to 8:59. And people were like banging on the door. They start banging on the door from like 5:02 because they're.
Oh, so you have like a private room to do it in as well?
Yeah, but then it's booked for the next slot. So there's a whole sort of like, I don't know, power aerobics class that are waiting to get in. And they're all beautiful people and they're just banging on the door like Night of the Living Dead, which we're going to talk about later. But but they keep banging on the door and they're like, and I'm just there going, well, they're going to come in, you know? We got to like 10 o'clock, and I was like, "Right, we're finished. We've got to finish." And I had to finish off my stretches, but I was just like, "We can't overrun because there's like literally 20 people outside that are waiting to come in." And then when we go out, it's like my trainer was the one that was pushing me to finish off everything. I was the one that was like going, "I like the session, but it's just like we've done the hour. It's, you know, there's 20 people, and then it's like a parade of shame, where the door opens, Kenny, this 7 foot tall kind of Adonis, he sort of like walks at hi Kenny, he walks out of the door, and then like 10 seconds later this. Fat, sweaty mess sort of like emerges, just like absolutely like his hair all matted to his face, and I'm just like, all right.
And does anyone ever go, oh, I loved you an uncle?
No, but I do get no, because I would never assume that people would had heard of me, but I do think that they think that it's a bit weird that I just have like a room to myself, but I wouldn't do it. But it's also sort of like I need to get into a certain amount.
Yeah.
I need to get into a certain amount of shape before I can actually start exercising in public.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
So you need to do like 3 years at the gym before you can just go to the gym and just like have enough. Yeah.
I don't know if this makes me want to be more likely to go. Maybe I'll just die early.
I mean, that's the easier option.
It's
much easier. It's not so much the dying early; it's the quality of life towards the end.
Sure.
So
sure.
I would just go. I just do it.
Yeah. I run a bit, but I never know if it does anything.
For mental health, I think it's as good a thing as any. I mean, I wrote a film about it. It was on
the exercise.
It was. I wrote my boxing film about it. But it is literally when you. I'm not boxing at the moment because I hurt my leg. It is sort of like the 1 hour a week where you just switch off and you can just concentrate on yourself. Like, not 1 hour a week. I go 3 times a week. But you can do 1 hour a week. You can do 2 hours a week. You can do...
12 hours
just,
a week.
Just something is good.
Yeah, right?
Even if it's a case of, like, walking for an hour. It's the 1 hour where you're literally... It's like doing a two-hour radio show for the first time, right?
But now the first hour is health and fitness every week. We've been... Did they know this?
That's what we're doing on Fan Club.
Yeah, so now health and fitness.
Yeah, health and fitness.
12 and 1, but, and then Fan Club at 1.
But I think that... The first time you do it, he tells you to do something and you think it's impossible. And then you go, I can't do it. There's absolutely no way I can do it. And then you do it. And then the second time you do it, you go, oh, it is possible. And I've done it. And then the first time you do it is always the hardest.
And do you still find it difficult to get up in the morning and go down there?
Never found it difficult to get up in the morning. That is a myth that I don't mind perpetuating. But I mean, when you're doing like a sitcom or something like that, you're getting up at 5:30 every day, and then you're going in, and you're in makeup at 7, and then you know what I mean. They're long days, and so you know, I'll tweet in the morning, and people say, "You're right. Oh, what are you doing up?" And it's just like I'm doing my job. This is my job. I'm not Mark Wahlberg. I mean, that looks like a fucking...
He gets up before he goes to bed. He gets up at 2 in the morning, doesn't he?
He gets up at 2. He goes to bed at 3. for the night before. Yeah. I mean, you can kind of work out what I tried to say. Anyway, so 2 hour slot. If it doesn't work, we won't do it again.
Mark Wahlberg has like, but he still plays golf, didn't he, for like 3 hours? Oh, no, there's one of them has an hour and a half that was a shower.
Mark Wahlberg plays golf for half an hour every day.
Oh, half an hour, that's
and
right.
You just like go, well, what's the fucking point in that? What is the point in that?
When does he make the films? That's what I want to know. How's he fit it in?
It's crazy, isn't it? Oh, anyway, but that's the price, isn't it? To be as famous as Mark Wahlberg, you need to have a joyless life.
Yeah.
So it's great to be on football with you now.
This is the best bit. Is it worth telling them about? No, we don't need to tell them. We don't ever do that before.
Well, tell them what?
What's coming on the show?
No, anything? We don't. What are you doing? Overthinking it. What,
we're overthinking it.
So what have you been up to this week?
I was on holiday a lot this week. I was with my parents in the Lake District, the pretty Lake District in Cumbria. So I haven't done much other than, the sort of the culture I've consumed in the last week has been, I watched a couple of old Minders on ITV4 when I was waiting for people to...
The show
Minder.
Right, not just... Yeah, okay.
I've not really seen any films. Have I seen any culture? Have I consumed anything?
You knew the show was coming up, right? It's every week.
Well, it's the one that's 2 hours, so I thought I'd specifically not...
Luckily for you, I've been to the fucking gym today.
We could talk about all kinds of things. I'll tell you what I watched the other week on Netflix. I watched that documentary that's about the He-Man and the Master Universe toys.
Oh, I watched that, yeah.
It's a weird thing, in it, because it feels like there is too much.
Natalie's telling me what I've seen. But this is actually, if you've listened to the show before, Natalie, I ask Nat what he's been up to. He tells me, and then I pretend to listen, and then I tell him what I've been up to. So, as you were, Nathaniel.
I watched that documentary about He-Man toys, and it was... And it feels like, when you're watching it, you go, this is too much information about He-Man. Do you know what I mean? It feels like...
I loved it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Do you get it from beginning to... And it feels like they're taking it far too seriously.
Well, I think it's either you or someone else, but every so often you'll post, like, a page out of the Argos catalogue.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to love the Argos catalogue.
Oh, me
catalogue.
Too, me too.
I mean, I could spend hours poring over the Argos catalogue.
And the worst thing is that as an adult, when that doesn't even exist anymore, you kind of get the same thrill... Of someone posting the little pictures and going, but it was only $3.99.
But I never had any. I did. That's not true. I had a couple of He-Man toys, but we had a mate down the road who had all the He-Man toys, and that happened twice actually. Then I moved, and then I had some of the Ghostbuster toys, and I had a mate over the road that had all the. And I was saving up for weeks and weeks to get an Ecto-1, and he just came round, and his mum had bought him one. And I was like, that's not fair. You knew that I was saving up for that. But the toys, the nostalgia for toys and stuff, I really love. But I did think that it was a great documentary. What I especially loved was Dolph Lundgren.
Me too. That was the stuff I found. I could have had a whole film about the film.
And what I really loved was how much Frank Langella loved playing Skeletor.
Oh, yeah.
He said it's his favourite part that he'd ever played.
Yeah.
You know,
now, like 30 years later, Frank Langella gets called up. He's done... Frost Nixon or whatever, and they go, oh, we're making a documentary about He-Man. It's a film you made. And he's like, yes, please, I'll be there. Can't wait, can't
wait. Of
course,
the role of Skeletor.
But it is
Skeletor,
like that.
Skeletor from Eternia.
But it is funny.
Who lived in Castle Grayskull. I remember it well. No, but he treated it like it was like
really
a Shakespearean
did.
Role. He loved it. And
When he did the makeup, I said, I need to have my eyes visible, and I need to have my face so I can show them. I don't want to wear a mask and cover up my face because I want to be Skeletor.
Because I never thought about it before, but when you actually watch Skeletor in Masters of the Universe, a flawed film, but one that I have fond memories of, he has teeth, doesn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yeah.
So it's like he's got lips and teeth, although his face is bone.
Yeah.
That was a film where it was weird because my dad took me to see it. I bought the Michael Jackson Megamix tape from R Price, and then we went down the road, and I guess it was the Holloway Odeon, and he took me to see Masters of the Universe. And we went in before the end of the previous showing.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know either. I mean, they had, like, proper showings, didn't they, back then?
Yeah.
like Psycho was the was the one that introduced that you're not allowed to go in early or late. Got to sort of.
But Holloway Lodeon had very lax.
I guess they did, because we went in and we saw the end of the credits and Skeletor comes out of the, spoiler alert, Skeletor comes out of the bottom of the bottomless pit that he falls down, and he comes out of the the pool of dirty water that he's fallen into, and he goes, "I'll be back." And he never was. Though. He never was. Much like Ming the Merciless. The end. Dot 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 question mark.
It is the
end.
It is
the end. Flash. Yeah, it is.
That's
the end.
You're not coming back.
It's the end for you. but so yeah, that scared me so much. I was a really squeamish child, right? It scared me so much that Skeletor jumping out of the pool at the bottom. We watched the whole film. And the credits were going on, and my dad said, "Well, you know, do you want to stick around and watch the end of the film again?" And I was like, "No, it's cool.
I've seen that.
Yeah, a bit tired actually. I was just trying to really style it out, but I was absolutely shitting myself. I was like, I don't want to see that again, Daddy."
Also, it'd be interesting to talk to Frank Langella about who was the character of Skeletor he was talking to at that point.
Sure, right.
What was he thinking? What was Skeletor's motivation for saying, "I'll be back," coming out of a dirty pool? Who was he saying it to?
Was he
not going, "Oh, I didn't die"?
Straight down the bowser it was. right down the barrel of the lens he was. So I really love Frank. I love how much Frank Langella loves it. I loved all the intricacies. Because there's another show which isn't as good called The Toys... that we grew up with.
I haven't seen those.
I don't think it's a great show. And they did Masters of the Universe, and I thought, well, what can this documentary actually add to that documentary? And loads. And I always knew that there was a Conan the Barbarian connection, but they completely missed that in the toys.
I think that's one of the interesting things about it.
It's really great that He-Man basically came up with, we've made all these toys that we can't sell to kids. How do we do it? We just change the heads.
All the bodies are
Arnold Schwarzenegger bodies. We just changed all the heads, and then it became like this thing. And that's why there's loads of snakes and Snake Mountain and stuff like that, I imagine.
Because that would have been
all
in
the stuff. But what I really, really especially love, I always love watching interviews with Dolph Lundgren, because he's such a lovely man.
Well, he comes across incredibly well.
He's so articulate as well, and it's weird because it's a skill that just never really shines through in any of his films, where you go, you never guess who's really great and articulate and clever and all that stuff. Dolph Lundgren. And he can barely put a sentence together when you watch him in a film. Yeah, I mean, he's like a rocket scientist, isn't he?
Oh yeah, I think he has been.
He's a certified. Is he a member of Mensa? He can do like 5 martial arts. He can drum. He directs and writes films now. He did a film actually called Command Performance, which is Die Hard at a gig. Where he plays the drummer, and he goes out for a spliff, passes out in the toilets, and when he comes to, there's been a terrorist attack.
When did this come out?
He wrote it, directed it, and starred in it, and plays the drums in it.
And is it good?
No.
Okay.
No, it's terrible. That's why I like my Dolph Lundgren bits in an interview.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just great in interviews. And there's also that amazing clip of him. It's kind of like a telethon. I guess it's like a Danish telethon where he comes out and he sings A Little Less Conversation.
I've not seen this.
Oh, my God. Oh, you've got to see it.
We should stop the show now and watch it.
Everybody, stop what you're doing. Pause the show and watch.
That's what we're going to do. We're going to go
Lundgren,
off and
A Little Less Conversation.
That sounds well up my street.
He sings A Little Less Conversation, and then he plays the drums, and then he does his stunt routine, and there's dancing girls and fireworks and everything. And then at the end of it, he comes back and finishes the song. I nicked it for the beginning of Heavy Entertainment, my pilot for Heavy Entertainment, because I just thought it's my favourite thing that I've ever seen. So we just like we tried to recreate it. But oh my God, yeah, Dolph Lundgren. I mean, I think out of all of them, he's probably the one that's got the most heart.
Yeah, he comes across like a really nice man. And he's also got quite good things to say about the film. He's got that thing where he's like, you know, it's not an amazing film. But also, it looks like when it's got William Stout, who's like a comic book artist who did a lot of the designs for it. When it shows you what they were drawing, you're going, this looks incredible.
Yeah.
I guess they just couldn't achieve it, but it does look like they
could afford it. There's amazing matte paintings in the film. And also, he couldn't speak any English when he made it, so he did it all phonetically. So I just, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a good film. And I, even when I was little, I was like, where's Battlecat? Where's Orca?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I didn't. So even when I was little, I kind of like was disappointed with what they did with He-Man. But, you know, there are bits in it that I quite like. And it's not necessarily that I like it. It's just that I've always remembered it fondly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I always remember the KFC stuff.
Yes.
Doesn't she work for? It's not probably KFC. It's probably just like
a generic fried chicken restaurant.
But Courtney Cox, and she gets the. And then it's got that weird. It was all a dream ending, and then.
Oh yeah.
It's just yeah. And what's really weird is that you've got Eternia, so why not set it all in 1986, planet Earth, in wherever it is, Denver. Where is it set?
It'll be
California. It's got Mr. Strickland in it.
Yes.
Reprising his Back to the Future role. What did he do? Just those three films?
Maybe. No, but he's probably one of those people that's a very respected character actor, isn't he? Like Frank Langella.
Right, sure.
He's probably one of those people that's been in a couple of films and then that'll be all they ever remembered for.
Frank Langella. I mean, funnily enough, I didn't know he was Skeletor when I was little, when I saw it. And
yeah.
Then I watched The Ninth Gate, which is Roman Polanski, Johnny Depp film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... You almost can't admit to have seen it. but there is a film called The Ninth Gate, and there's a bit, spoiler alert, there's a bit towards the end, it came out in 1999, and there's a bit towards the end where, hang on.
Spoiler!
Brilliant.
Nailed it.
There was a bit in The Ninth Gate where Frank Langella gets set on fire. And it's like, because he's a devil worshipper, and he does this thing with his hand where he kind of like waves his hand around his face and he kind of like rolls his head back. And I was just like, that's exactly what Skeletor does when he's becoming Master of the Universe at the end of Masters of the Universe. And then I Googled it and I was like, fucking hell! Frank Langella, you are...
I love that that's how you recognise him.
That's how I recognise him.
He's on fire and you go... Is that Skeletor?
Well, I love the fact that he loved Skeletor so much that he put it in other films. He put bits of the performance in other films. I just loved it.
Maybe that's a prequel, and that's how he gets all burnt up and skull-like.
Oh, it's a shared universe.
It's a shared universe.
That's how you do it. That's how Roman you do
Polanski
it, Universal.
Roman Polanski's The Ninth Gate. Is in the same cinematic universe as Master of the Universe with Dolph Lundgren.
I really liked Frank Langella in Cutthroat Island as well.
Oh yeah, that's a good movie.
I find that really weird. How much what I would imagine is that no one has seen Cutthroat Island.
What? No one ever.
I just think that
it was like a notorious flop, though, wasn't it?
It was a huge flop, but I think it cost a lot of money. Michael Douglas was originally in it, and he kind of like had loads of demands, and then Rennie Harlan came in as the director, who was Gina Davis's husband, and then it was the Gina Davis show, and not the Gina Davis show, that was another show, but then it was like it became all about Gina Davis, and so Michael Douglas left, Matty Modine came in, and then I think they filmed in Malta, and it just went so over budget, and it was pirates and pirate ships, but it was like what, 1995, 96?
Yeah, about 95,
and like 4 or 5 years later Pirates of the Caribbean came along, and everyone was just like, you're not going to make fucking pirate films don't sell, but it's weird because I imagine that, well, I don't think you could probably maybe at the peak of pirate stuff, I mean they've just buried it at sea, haven't they? You couldn't make any more pirate films now, I don't think.
Was it you telling me that? Because notoriously, like anything that's set at sea is very expensive to film because you can only film for like. Because the daylight's so obvious.
The sky changes all the time. You've got so much sky and so much sea, and both of those things change all the time. Plus, you can't keep the boat still. I mean, you just don't ever film at sea, just never do it. Yeah, Cutthroat Island, what was I saying?
Pirates of the Caribbean, you wouldn't make one
now. The most expensive film ever made, the third most expensive film ever made is something like Pirates of the Caribbean 4.
Oh, wow.
Like the one that they did after Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley left.
Yeah, that would be 4.
I think that was at the time the most expensive film ever made.
Is it crazy?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it is. But I guess at that point they can go, it's a huge franchise, right? There's one of the, there's quite a good sort of tell-all documentary on one of the Pirates of the Caribbean Blu-rays, which is one of those ones where, I think it's when they're making the second one, that they're making these two together, and it's going into production, and I think they might even have started filming it, but there's a point in it when they realise it's going to cost way more than they think it would. And they actually, in the documentary, you've got this bit where they're going, we, over the weekend, like, who is it? Is it Warner Brothers or whoever, whatever studio made it, have to decide whether they're going to pull the plug on it. This right. massive... Massive
it's
big franchise.
The it's the
oh, yeah, yeah. The oh, is it the first one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. And they're having this, and you've got Gore Verbinski, the director's running around going, I'm basically doing all this maths over the weekend to try and say, like, we basically need this, otherwise we're off. Like, on Monday, we just shut down production.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's really, I love those kind of documentaries that are but official documentaries that are real, like tell all.
Yeah, yeah, tell all, and they like these are the, these were the problems. But yeah, that Pirates of the Caribbean film was kind of crazy. They wanted Johnny Depp to be, you know, like an all American hero.
Right.
They wanted basically Errol Flynn. Well, not an Errol Flynn though. What did they want? They wanted kind of
a roguish kind of. Like a Han Solo-y type thing.
They wanted like a Dwayne Johnson character and then two little sidekicks. And then what they actually had was they had a romance story and then they had Keith Richards.
Yeah.
And when Disney saw that, they were just like, what the fuck is he doing? But like within earshot, they were so furious. They go, what the fuck is he doing? He's fucking up our film. This is so expensive. And, was, and everyone had to just go, he like almost got fired and was just go with it, just go with it. And then they,
but it must have looked like that. You could almost see it from their perspective, right? If you were on set, you'd be like,
what's he doing?
Oh god, what's this?
He's ruining our film.
I think that first Pirates of the Caribbean film, his performance in that is great, and it was one I remember him getting like an Oscar nomination for it.
Yeah.
And I remember going, that's absolutely correct though, because he absolutely turned a film which without him that film would probably be really boring.
It would have been considered like I imagine Cutthroat Island, which
yeah.
did have the kind of like basically Matthew Modine looks like Errol Flynn in it.
Yeah.
And but the thing that I didn't really love Pirates of the Caribbean. It had walking skeletons and stuff like that, mm-hmm. like out of Army of Darkness and Jason and the Argonauts.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that's exactly tick box. Pirates, I loved. I used to dress mm-hmm. up as pirates for fancy dress parties. I love pirates. I liked Johnny Depp at the time, and so it, was, it sort of ticked all my things. Mm-hmm. And then it was just like I didn't like it. My favourite thing about Pirates is Monkey Island. When I was growing up, did you ever play Monkey Island?
No.
Oh man, you can get it for your
phone, probably.
For your phone, yeah, it's brilliant. Monkey Island was these point and click adventure games that were done by LucasArts, and they were so funny. Like they were actually like genuinely just like funny. Funny games that
I think I've seen this, and it is like you talk to people in it, right?
Yeah, you and talk they have to people little... and you have to do a sword fight, but instead of the sword fight you trade insults, and you've got to go around the town and insult enough people so you've built up enough insults so that you know what to say. And it's just brilliant. And the first one was the first Monkey Island was just like my favourite thing, and then the second Monkey Island was as good if not a little bit better. But the first two were great, and then they've made some ones that later where they had like there was good, but I don't like enjoy the animation as much. But back in the day, like 1992, when I was playing Monkey Island, the animation was so pixelated, it was a bit amazing. It's almost like the game that he plays in Big,
right? Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Like 4 years later,
yeah, yeah.
So that it was a slightly improved. They were a bit more. They used a few more colours, but they're just really. You're playing them, they're like puzzles, and it's really funny, and it's a story that you enjoy. It's just great. And to the point where, you know, you'd have to collect items, like a pot or a piece of string or something like that, and you'd have to find the items and then find combinations of how to use them. And I play it so much that in my normal real life, when I wasn't on the computer, I would see a pot and I'd pick the pot up and I can use that. And then I was like, I'm not in the game. We should probably play a song.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play a song.
Thoughts were drawn, falling into me. I was in the wheel, shadow of the world. I'm a dark horse. a bed of nails. Love hurts good on a bed of nails. I'll lay you down, and when all else fails, I'll drive you like a hammer on a bed of nails. Our love is a bed of nails. Love hurts good on a bed of nails. I'll lay you down, and when all else fails, I'll drive you like a hammer on a bed of nails. I'll get on a bed of nails. I'll drive you like a hammer on a bed of nails. Ow, 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 ow. Gonna drive you like a hammer, baby. Put me in your slammer, oh yeah. I'll drive you like a hammer on a bed of nails. Ow, 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 ow. I'll drive you, drive you, drive you, drive you, drive you, drive you, drive you like a hammer on a bed of nails.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
That was Bed of Nails by Alice Cooper.
But what's it about?
It's about fucking.
Right.
It's about fucking. He doesn't sing it anymore. He doesn't sing it live because he's a Christian.
That's still all right. Still Christian, isn't
you're
it?
You're allowed to fuck if you're a Christian.
I hope
more so.
More so,
if anything.
probably have to.
You probably have to.
To procreate and things, don't you?
Yeah, sure. But yeah, yeah, it's weird because he did like a couple of albums in the late... mid to late 80s that were all about fucking, and there's just this huge gap in his performance repertoire where you go, he does early Alice Cooper, sure, he does later Alice Cooper, sure.
Would he not do it? It seems, I don't know, it seems
the only one he does is Poison, because he has to,
right?
Because that was
a massive
Poison is arguably the reason why you're at that concert, because if it had just been Schools Out, he would have petered away into obscurity.
And he just would have been a nostalgia act.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, he kind of he isn't, because he still. What's really exciting, I've seen him so many times now that every so often he'll come on and he'll do a song, and he did a song called Freedom, I think, on the last tour from I think it was from Constrictor, and. But these, the Constrictor and Raise Your Fist and Yell, are my two least listened to albums of his. No, that and Lace and Whiskey. I'm such a nerd when it comes to it that he'll come out and he'll do a song that's like he did Clones at Alexander Palace, and I just turned around and went, "Oh, he never does this. He never does this." And everyone else that I'm with is just kind of like, "We don't care." And I just think that's actually probably the bare minimum that you would ask for a musician that you've seen 30 times.
Like give us one more. Give us a new one.
Every ten times you see him, he'll put in a new song and you go, "Oh, thank you." Even when he's doing like a new album, promoting a new album, he'll do like one song from the new album.
Oh, really?
And it'll be a real weird one as well. Welcome to My Nightmare from a couple of years ago, he did Caffeine from it. And he came out with a big one of them JBB Sports mugs. Like he had like an oversized mug, and he sung a
full of blood.
No, coffee.
Coffee, because it's caffeine.
Because it's about caffeine, and he sung the song Caffeine, and you go, yeah, but that's such a weird track out of all of the songs. But I guess all of them were sort of telling a story, so it was almost like a standalone. I fucking love Caffeine. That's a great song. Anyway,
what have you been a fan of this week?
Well, what have I seen this week?
Yeah, what have you seen?
I saw... I saw Bradley Cooper's directorial debut, A Star Is Born.
That is a film that's been remade about six times, isn't it?
Yeah, loads of times. They did it with James Mason and Judy Garland. Mm-hmm. Then it was... they did it again. And then there was one with Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson in the 70s. And I think they remake it like every 20 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've seen it. Yeah. It was almost exactly what I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It was really good.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll tell you this, right? I saw Piranha 2 this week.
Okay.
Right? James Cameron's Piranha 2, The Flying Spawn, or whatever it's called. That is a bad film.
Yeah.
I think I must have seen it before.
I've seen Piranha. I don't know that I've seen Piranha 2.
Piranha 2 is even more of a lift off from Jaws, where they've actually stolen the plot.
Right.
It's like a guy that there's a scientist woman that knows more than anyone else and says you've got to close down the beaches, and then there's a guy that says, are you kidding? I'm not going to close down the beaches. That's where all, and you go, I mean, that's literally just from Jaws, right? And I'm watching Piranha 2, and I know it's a bad film, and yet there's like Lance Henriksen's in it. And
that's nice.
Oh, I love him. Yeah. And it's a really good performance, of course, because he's like, I don't know why they don't work together anymore, but he was like James Cameron's lucky charm for a few films. And so, like, there's elements in Piranha that I did enjoy, Piranha 2 that I did enjoy, even though I know it's a bad film.
Right.
Now, A Star is Born, I couldn't tell whether it was a good or a bad film, like, at all.
Right.
There is like the way he the way he's directed the live. It starts with a concert with concert footage, and it's the best representation of
what a live experience.
Like if you did concert videos, so far AC/DC Live at River Plate I think is the best concert. DVD that I've ever seen, concert video that I've ever seen, because it makes you feel like you're actually there. With this film, because it's like a narrative thing, he's just, and it was produced by Live Nation, so what I imagine was they got to do was, because it's Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga, so what I imagine they got to do was they got to Lady Gaga was doing a gig, and then Bradley Cooper would come out before the gig and go, I'm just going to
take a few shots,
making a film with Lady Gaga, can we film some stuff.
I imagine they do it officially.
Well, at the beginning, that beginning scene is shot at Glastonbury. It was so good. And then at Coachella. Okay, cool. Right. Well, the first the opening of the thing's got so much energy to it, and it really captures what live performance is all about. And I just thought, you know, we are in for a fucking treat.
Mm-hmm.
And then the film is just really good. Bradley Cooper, as an actor, is fantastic. Like I've never been a fan of Bradley Cooper.
Right.
I never got on board really after the Hangover films, and so I was kind of like a little bit like dragging my feet to go and see it, and yeah, I just thought he was so good in it as an actor, and I think as a director, he was visually very good. But I mean, I've directed stuff, and you do rely a lot on your cinematographer.
Yeah.
So you're watching it from that point of view going, yeah, right, okay, what's Bradley Cooper and what's the thing? But that energy, and then I just think I think Bradley Cooper in the edit could have been a little bit kinder to Lady Gaga in a couple of places where I think that he fell in love a little bit with his leading lady, and there's a couple of clearly improvised bits which you go, yikes, you know, not that she's ever bad, she's really good in it, and it's an amazing performance. Everyone is going to get Oscar nominated for this film.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, Bradley Cooper is absolutely phenomenal in it. Like I mean, and it doesn't pain me to say it, but I'm surprised to say it. But you can't really shake the fact that he is also, he's written it and he's produced it and he's directed it and he's in it. And he really is kind of, it's the showy part, right?
Yeah.
And when he's not on screen, everyone's going, oh, where's Bradley? Do you know what I mean? But it's got a fucking amazing cast. It's got Andrew Dice Clay in it.
Who I'm
really enjoying his latter day performances. It's got Andy Griffin in it, like in just one really short shot. It's got Dave Chappelle in it. They're quite small parts, and Sam Elliott, which is weird because the night before I'd gone down to Brighton to watch The Big Lebowski.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I just love Sam Elliott in that film. He's hardly in it.
He's basically like God, isn't he?
He's like this cow. You get the impression that that everyone's in love with the dude.
Mm.
You know, so like Walter's in love with the dude, and but he's like in a relationship with Donnie. And then Sam Elliott turns up at the end, and he's in love with the dude, and you know, the dude says, "Oh, I like your look, I like your style. You got the whole cowboy thing going on," and he just does this whole kind of like this. He does this little cowboy blush where he's just like, "Oh, thank you very much." So I love Sam Elliott. He's yeah, he's fucking good in the thing. There's just some weird shots that go on a little bit too long, and you go, no, yeah, I get it. There's a bit when he's reversing out the car crying. He's got his car, and he's Sam Elliott is reversing out the drive crying, and he turns over his shoulder. The camera's behind him, and he turns over his shoulder, and Sam Elliott, it's got tears in his eyes, and you go, oh, he's crying. And then he turns back forward, and then he turns around again, and then the second time he turns around, he goes, is he crying? Oh, I thought he was crying, but it's rested on him for so long that I'm not actually sure what the point of the... Do you know what I mean? You got the information, and so I think that it could have been a little bit tight in some places, but I think that everyone in the entire theatre next to me were bawling their eyes out by the end of it.
Oh, really?
And you go, all right, I don't think I'm a cynical person, but I think that it's a mainstream hit.
Okay.
Whereas I spend my weeks watching Piranha 2 and going, oh gosh, I love.
Do you think it's showy because in that way that sometimes people who are like, because he is a director and it's his directorial debut, he feels he's got to be a bit more showy than he would be if he was just trying to tell a story.
This isn't just like a directorial debut. This is like a militant attack on the Oscars. This is like, we're going to get, it's got original music in it, it's going to get best song, it's going to get best cinematography, it's going to get best director, best actor, best actress, it's going to get supporting, it's going to go across the board, it's going to get everything. It might not get a screenplay, mm-hmm. but and it's such a familiar story, whether you've seen the originals or not,
yeah.
You know exactly where it's going, you know exactly what's going to happen. But it just really does deliver that. Andrew Dice Clay was cast over Robert De Niro, John Turturro, and John Travolta.
Interesting.
I think that's great, then.
I think that's the correct thing, isn't it?
I think that if it had been Robert De Niro, who they've worked with in the past, if it had been in any of the others, it would have kind of totally distracted. It's the right size part for an Andrew Dice Clay, where it's showy, it's funny. He plays her dad, basically, and he's great in it. But... but I think anyone else would have been a mistake. What do you think I'm doing? Do you think I'm going to talk about A Star Is Born for another fucking 15 minutes? Fucking hell. Jesus Christ. You can't hear this at home. But constantly while we're here, I'm being told that I'm doing it wrong. It's like having sex. So we've got a guest coming up now.
We've got a special guest. We're about to have Dana Ashbrook from who's Bobby Briggs on Twin Peaks.
Bobby Briggs.
Who's going to be he's going to be down the line, as they say, yeah. On radio parlance.
I mean, you've got us to start introducing the part, but you've only just picked up the phone to get him on the line.
Well, I think Natalie's quite excited because she's a big fan of
If I was to give
Dana
A Star Is Born a rating out of 5, I wouldn't, because I don't believe in that sort of system.
Yes. But would you recommend I go and see it, Nick? Do you think I'd like it?
I wouldn't necessarily. I'd recommend it to my mum.
Right. Okay.
And my dad would like it as well because of the music side of it and all that.
What kind of music is it? Is it
It's a game of two halves. It's very much rock music at the beginning and then Lady Gaga takes over.
Okay, okay.
Can somebody come in here and teach me how to use the thing? And so if you like Lady Gaga, there's a bit of a weak song that she does on a TV appearance that she does in the show and everyone reacts like it's the best song ever and you go, oh, I've missed something here. But the music, the first half of the music is really great. It's like country rock music.
Yeah, I like that when there is a discrepancy between what's actually happening and what's happening on screen, when you're meant to sort of go, oh, that's an amazing song, yeah. But it isn't.
Bradley Cooper's basically playing Jesus Christ as an alcoholic, and he does a better job with it than it had any right
We've
to
got
be.
Producer Natalie in the studio now, who's going to be...
What are you doing? Put it up. No, that one. And
speak.
Hello,
is that Dana?
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Yes, it is. Hi. How you? I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well. You're over here for the Twin Peaks UK Festival.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Are you in London right now?
Yeah, I'm in. I'm in Green Park actually. Just sitting in the grass in the sun. It's beautiful here.
You could have come in and paid us a visit. We've got you on the phone. So, and Twin Peaks has been a part of your life now for over 25 years.
Oh, yeah. I think the first time I read the pilot was, like, in January of 1989.
Wow. And does it...
Yeah, yeah.
Does it follow you around? Do you feel... Is it like a... It must be a proud association, though, to have kept it going for so long.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it was kind of... it was a huge shock that it came back, that it came back after 25 years. But, yeah, it's always been a real sort of a pillar in my career of at least something that people like. You know what I mean? It's rare that I do stuff that people like.
And it was a big shock then when it came back last year. It wasn't something that had been sort of vaguely planned, or it was often discussed, wasn't it, as something that might come back one day.
I mean, maybe in the earlier years, right after the first, you know, thing. But after a while, it just kind of, you know, went away. And I always just went off of what David Lynch said, which was, you know, it's deader than a doornail, I think, is what he used to say.
Oh, wow.
So. I just thought it was kind of a thing that we put to bed, but I guess people had other plans.
If I take you back then to 1989, so when you got that first pilot script for Twin Peaks, did you at the time did you think of it as being something that was completely new and original? Was that obvious right from the get go?
Yeah, man, it was. It was called the Northwest Passage at that time, and the casting director. Was a friend of mine that had tried to cast me in another show that she'd done. So I'd been in her office many times. And her son is the guy that plays Leo. His name's Eric DeRay. That
oh,
was
wow.
the casting director, Joanna Rae's son. Yeah. So he used to actually be in the office and run the sessions when we would go in for auditions. And so, when I went in to go meet on this show called Northwest Passage, I got into the office and I talked to Eric about it. And we were just talking about the script and how it was the woman with the patch and the silent drape runners and all the stuff, you know, we were laughing about that and we thought it was amazing, you know, but I'd never seen anything like it, but I was so green. I was a new young actor at that time. So I didn't really have any experience with anything. So I kind of lucked into it.
Wow. And were you aware yourself of David Lynch at the time and the movies he'd made?
Only Elephant Man. Actually, was the movie that I knew that he directed was because my mother was also an actress in where I'm from in San Diego. She was like a sort of a local theater actress, and she did a production of The Elephant Man. She played the actress in it, and so I knew the play really well. And so when the movie came out, you know, we all went to see it because it was such an important thing in our lives, and it just happened to be David Lynch that directed it. So that was my only knowledge of David Lynch at that time. I didn't know any of Eraserhead or Blue Velvet or any of the shorts or any of that stuff. So,
and was there when you got the call to come back that it was going to return? Was there any doubt in your mind that you'd do it?
No. I just was hoping that it was, you know, it was, I would have done anything. I would have done, just I'd walk by with a wave. I didn't care. I just wanted to see these people again, you know? So it was no hesitation whatsoever. I was just glad that they were doing it the way they were doing it, you know, that it was a continuation and not like trying to
rehash something. Yeah. Oh, very much so. Feels like, it really feels to me like Twin Peaks is one of those shows that's really kind of redefined what modern television is now, right? It doesn't feel like you'd have things like The Sopranos or Mad Men or
right.
those kind of shows without Twin
right,
Peaks,
right.
right? It really does feel like, and especially for a show that would have been like a network TV show, it really did change everything,
oh, yeah.
didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you look at what was out there the same year that Twin Peaks first came out, you know, the shows all looked the same as they always did. You know, it was, you know, every room is lit to the hilt, you can see every corner. There's just absolutely nothing cinematic about the way they used to shoot it. They used to shoot it in, you know, 5 to 6 days, a whole episode, and just rip through television, you know, and there was no real cinematic quality to it. And I think when David, you know, came out with Twin Peaks, you know, it was like you got to see TV as more of a cinematic sort of thing and a higher quality on every level, music, lighting, production design, all that stuff. It's just the level went up.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, it became more difficult to do good television because, you know, they used to just pound it out. And then after Twin Peaks, you know, everyone sort of took a little more care and realize that you can do it a little bit more, a little bit better.
I think that's it. It ups the game, doesn't it? Because everyone, and it's quality. There's sort of like a quality to it that I think people assumed you didn't need or people might not enjoy. But it really does feel like a lot of the Twin Peaks episodes are like mini movies, aren't they? They're just like an hour long movie. It feels like a real sort of almost cinematic experience.
Exactly. And they're just so beautiful to watch. And, you know, everything technically is pretty interesting. The sound design, all that stuff is above and beyond what normal television does these days, you know, in the early days. Now, it's, you know, there's a lot. As Michael Horace would say, the Twin Peaks' DNA is all over the shows that are out today.
Absolutely.
And, you know, like David Chase, the guy that created The Sopranos, you know, talks about how Twin Peaks inspired him for a lot of stuff on The Sopranos and you know, especially the dream sequence stuff that Tony Soprano had in...
Oh, of course,
In The Sopranos, he talked about it in interviews and stuff like that. So, you know, that's flattering. I mean, I really didn't have anything to do with that because it's all David Lynch. But, you know, it's just flattering to be a part of something that you know.
And it does feel like that to you. That's nice that it feels like that to you as well, right? That you feel like you're part of some sort of big phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a small cog in a very giant machine, but, you know, I just feel lucky to be involved. You know, really, my goal on the new one was when I got it, and I saw the way they kind of made my character grow and change. I just wanted to make sure I didn't mess it up. I don't want to fuck it up.
I think Bobby Briggs is a character that probably changes most from in-between series as well, right? You've got a completely different, almost even the way you act and everything about it, he really has, like, grown up, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene in the second series where my dad tells me about a dream he had, and it sort of explains that Bobby's, you know, going to turn out okay, and nothing ever really came of that other than it just being a really cool scene, and then it sort of was proved out in the third series where you got to kind of see how Bobby ended up. Yeah,
yeah. Well, that's it. He does change.
It was really fun.
He does change even over the course of that first couple of series, though, doesn't he? You kind of do get the impression there's a lot more to him than you first get. And I guess he almost starts off as slightly more sort of a two-dimensional kind of bad kid, and then you kind of get the idea of what he's about.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's all the writing. That's all them. That's all those guys. I just trying to just do what they put on the page. You know, we got really lucky with Twin Peaks. We had good writers, and, you know, David and Mark and then all the people that wrote the series. We just were really lucky, you know, we're lucky to have those people. So they wrote cool stuff for me to do. Literally, I wish I was as cool as that, you know.
So you weren't anything like the character at the time then?
No, God, no. I mean, other than just, you know, being a young human being, no, I was nothing like that.
Because he's gone from, like, he's quite an intense character as well, isn't he, at the beginning? And it's nice, it's kind of, it's a weird thing that I think when you enjoy a series like that, how nice it is to sort of see how he turned out. And he's like, oh, he's turned out well. You actually feel like it's almost like a family member or something. And I think...
that's good.
I think between...
That's great, I'm glad you feel that way.
Between the two series as well, it feels like it's become a real sort of saga, isn't it? So you've now got a second generation of characters and... it feels like he sort of, in a way, David Lynch has almost like redefined TV again, right? There's really nothing else like it. When they did The Return, I mean, still, again, he's gone in and gone, oh, now we've got lots of TV that's like Twin Peaks, so I'm going to go a step further and do something else again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a little bit harder these days to kind of shock the audience or scare the audience or do anything they haven't already seen, you know. Pretty much everything's been thrown out there at this point. David doesn't, you know, watch a lot of stuff, other stuff, you know, so he doesn't get influenced by that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So everything that comes out of him is from a place of, you know, his own imagination. So, yeah, I mean, definitely there's that element to it. And the fact that he did a series the way he did on the new season on The Return, it's, not like anything else on television, that's for sure. You can watch it, you know, four or five times each episode and get something different out of it or see some new stuff or whatever, you know. It's like I don't want to sound too heady or anything, but it's kind of like a piece of art where you can go and see it and then go back to it the next day and see it a different way. And, you know, it's just that to me is what David is. You know, he's a painter that's making movies.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. What incredible sort of. I guess it's a real sort of privilege as well to work with someone like that. He's such a kind of icon as well, isn't he?
Unbelievable. That's the luckiest thing ever, is that I got to, you know, somehow be involved with someone like that. Because, you know, if you look at cinema and look at the people that are at the top of their game, he's, you know, one of them up there. And I haven't worked with that many people that are up there on his echelon. So it's really thrilling for me and lucky for me to be able to be involved with something like that.
Is it your first time in the UK? Have you been here before?
Well, I've been here many times before. I love it here. I guess this is the first time I've been back in 4 years.
Oh, so, wow. So you're a regular visitor.
Here in 2014. Yeah, I mean, I came here as a kid. My dad was a drama teacher, so he would every year take his students. He was a college drama teacher, so he would take his students on a trip to London where they'd come here for like 10 days and see like, you know, 15 plays in 10 days, catching two a day sometimes, and just really immerse themselves in the London theater scene. So I got to come here as a kid and do that stuff and go to Stratford and you know, get to do the RSC and all that stuff. So it was really great for me as a kid. And I love London. You know, London's a beautiful, beautiful city. I love it.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on. And the ninth official Twin Peaks UK Festival is on tomorrow on Sunday, isn't it? The London Irish Centre at Camden Square Gardens. And you can go and meet Dana and lots of other cast
members.
Come on out. Yeah, come and get it. So it's
please come on out, everybody. It'll be fun. We'll talk about all things Twin Peaks.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, man. Thank you. Really
no problem at
it.
All. Thank you. Goodbye.
All right. Have a good one.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. That was great.
Bro, thank you.
You did a really good job.
Thank you.
Really good.
Thank you.
I've not seen Twin Peaks. I had absolutely nothing to add to that. But I listened to the whole thing. I thought it was really great. Well done. Also, I talked about Star Is Born. I think that's a good format, don't you think?
Yeah.
Chat at the beginning.
Bit of a chat.
And then either one of us has seen something, a review, and then an interview.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll try and do that every week.
And probably talk about stuff off. Yeah. Off air.
Well, here's a song. bye. We're doing another hour. Yeah, good.
What?
She got a brown suntan starting just above her collar. Her lower arms were brown, but the rest is kind of pale. She'd buy betadine if she only had a dollar. She'd live out in the pasture if she only had a tail. And no, I don't see her much since she started with horses. No, I don't see her much since she started to ride. Well, her jeans, they get like a wet saddle blanket. And her boots are like you'd figure. And her car is full of hay. Horses, humans, if she had to rank it, you bet on they the canter and them that need fly spray. And you see, I don't see her much since she started with horses. No, I don't see her much since she started to ride. Go, boys, tell them all about it. Much since she started to train. Cannon bone, knee bone, forearm and arm. Well, I don't see her much once she heads for the bottom. That's so satisfied when she's riding and training. She must just love that smell of the barn, I would say. She's so satisfied when she's grooming and graining. And she's tired in the evening and she's gone in the day. And no, I don't see her much since she started with horses. No, and I don't see her much since she started to ride.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back, and we're entering
the second hour, the second leg.
The last leg of the show.
Fan Club. Speaking of, we've got to make the connection, otherwise it doesn't...
No, fuck it. I mean, I could feel my balls shrivel into my body as I was saying it. And he just was not impressed with any of it. Can you hear... No, don't talk yet. We haven't...
Can you still hear us when you haven't got your headphones?
Right, good. Okay, good. So we're joined in the studio now by my friend and yours, Mr... Josh Whitaker.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well.
The reason
how are
I
you?
Took off my headphones is they're really loud.
Oh, are they?
So I was hearing you too well.
I have.
I can hear you now, it's fine.
Can you hear us without the headphones? We exist in real life.
Totally, but
it feels like an actual conversation. And then when you put the headphones on, you realise it's radio.
Yeah.
You know, you present a radio show.
Yeah, I know. I'd wear the headphones for it.
The cans.
It just makes it feel like it's a real thing.
It does, doesn't it? I'll put them back on.
No, there's too loud for you.
I thought, no, that's fine. It's fine.
It's bad. They've done something.
Oh, no, it's still too loud.
No, I don't want to say that.
That's FUBAR!
That's Fan Club. What have I done?
Turning the headphones down.
It's a professional operation, this, Josh. Are you used to working with such...
I've never been able to turn down headphones in my life, so I'll worry about it. Yeah, that's perfect.
I'm not worried. I don't need to apologise to Josh for our show. It's a little bit like someone's visited your house and you weren't expecting them, and he's just like, "Don't go in the bathroom." just going to tidy up.
I love you've chosen the bathroom as that's the most vivid room, isn't it?
Someone came out of my house the other day, and it was unannounced, and you just forget what sort of state. I live on my own at the moment, so I don't have anyone to impress.
I don't think anyone should be coming round unannounced. No, at all.
And going straight for the bathroom. Absolutely not.
Were they just calling in to use the bathroom?
No, they weren't. They were coming in to get drunk. But I wanted to make...
I was on holiday the last week with my parents in Cumbria.
Lovely.
And they've got a thing there where all our relatives live there. No one locks their door and they just walk in. And I find it makes me feel sick.
Does the idea
of just going, yeah. Imagine if that was your
neighbors,
house.
Neighbours.
No, like you just go into like your relative's house, but they've got the door open. So my mum and dad just walk into people's houses.
Like in Coronation Street.
Yeah, it's very much like that.
But then, is it really like that in Coronation Street?
I don't know, it's a kind of myth,
it's
isn't
like,
it?
Because it's a bit like, I would imagine if it's on telly, it's a little bit like not saying goodbye at the end of a phone call. It just quickens everything up, doesn't it?
Or when they ask for lager. I'll have a lager, please. Lager?
But that's different, isn't it? That's because you can't say brand names.
Oh, sure, but it has but that, you kind of know
brand
it.
Name. Anyone can do the knock. It's not like that's copyrighted. It's just like, they're using my knock. But that would be like, you just end up with a soap opera with loads of scenes of people waiting on the doorstep going, he's not in. I'll give it another knock.
The thing with a knock is you could set up the character with their knock.
It could be a twat.
You could do anything you wanted. I don't know if the knock actually picked
it
up
is
on the
something
camera.
On locking a door. I remembered this week that, so I grew up in Devon on Dartmoor.
Of course I did.
Wouldn't expect anything else. And we didn't just not lock our house when we were in. We didn't lock it when we were out, to the point where I don't think we had a key. We lived that much in the middle of nowhere, and it felt totally normal to me until last week someone mentioned something along those lines, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's like when I... And I was like, oh, that's mad.
Yeah, I think maybe a lot of these houses up north are like that. Maybe we
Can
should
I just say my parents have moved and they do now lock the house?
Sure. For the best.
But maybe we should just plan like an outing. Where we can drive up north and see how much we can get.
I'd imagine in Dartmoor, though, they're probably quite welcoming, wouldn't they? You'd probably, if you got sort of parents that would go, they'll come in.
Yeah,
have a biscuit.
Well, you just never see anyone, so you might as well invite anyone in.
My family are all from up north and they always lock the doors, I'm sure.
Where up north, though? Probably some rough area.
Well, I say up north. Where's Staffordshire? That's not like north north,
that's
is that?
North Midlands.
And then my dad's Yorkshire.
Yeah, that's the north.
So, but they did ring the door. There was... I've just had a memory.
That's all right. It's going to happen.
I was at my grandparents' house one Christmas, and they rang on the door, and there was charity collectors, and they live in a cul-de-sac, and there was this giant float that was going up this cul-de-sac with Santa Claus on it, and you just think it's a dead end. But how are you going to fucking turn that at the end? You've got to turn it round and come all the way down. This giant float with Santa Claus on it, and the elves rang on the doorbell with collection buckets, and we all, as a family, all seven or eight of us, all stuck our heads out the door, and we looked out, and Santa Claus turned around and looked at us and went, "Having a do?" Loved it. Yeah. Having a do. Here we are, thank you, Santa. What are you working on at the moment, Josh?
I'm writing a stand-up tour.
Oh, really?
Yeah, as of the last week.
You didn't sound... you sounded that you saying that in a kind of worrying way.
Well, I'm at the first stage.
When's
of
the
it.
Tour?
Next autumn, so it's fine.
So
I've got a year.
Okay, you've got a year to write it.
But Last Leg's back next week, so I've got 1 week to write it. So I'm trying to write it because...
Because you need to, because otherwise...
Otherwise...
Because you're going to just have...
be disastrous.
Because I imagine at this stage in your career, your early previews are the worst previews that you've ever
had
in your life.
Awful.
Because everyone's coming to see Josh Widdicombe.
Well, no, luckily I've been doing double headers with Alan Carr, so everyone's going to see Alan Carr, so it's even worse. So I'm basically supporting Alan Carr, who's really brilliant. So my confidence has already been knocked straight away.
I was just about to wonder, what do you reckon the level of goodwill is in terms of minutes?
5 minutes.
If you had no material and you went out and said, hi,
Well, I found that out earlier this week. 2 minutes?
Funnily enough, I saw Alan Carr twice in 1 week, and he was just doing new material, and this is where you go fucking hell, it's absolutely impossible to be here. This is like 5 years ago, and the toilets, the Gingrich, is it?
Shepherd's Bush.
Yeah.
So they converted some public toilets into a gig.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as good as it sounds.
As you can tell.
That's showbiz.
And I was on with Alan Carr, and he did a gig, and they kind of gave him free 5 minutes grace period, and then after that, it was just kind of like, where are the jokes? Mm. And then maybe 4 or 5 days later, I was on the boat.
Tattershall Castle.
They've taken a boat, converted it into a gig. You never do gigs
in a comedy venue.
I hate rooms. So I did this gig on the boat, and he was there, and he came up to me, and he said, "He goes, hey, we've got to stop meeting up like this, haven't we?" And then he went on stage, and he fucking smashed it with the same material from the week before, and he just rewritten it, just tweaked it, and worked out. And you just like go, he was fucking busy at the time, really hard working. You got to be, and. But fucking hell, that was when I was just like, oh wow, this is a different thing.
Yeah.
He's so good, and you realise, the problem is with it, you realise, like, you know when we started comedy and you think it's just, I remember people saying, you've just got to keep gigging, but it's actually the bit between the gigs that I find where I need, because you'd see people and they'd be doing, they're gigging every night, but you'd see them a year apart and they're doing the same thing that's not working.
Yes.
It's kind of, that's the problem.
I like the phrase.
The problem with comedy is you get out what you put in, really, isn't it?
I like the phrase, when we started comedy, because it almost suggests that it was just us.
when we invented
comedy.
When we wrote the first joke.
That is true. I'm having a fallow year.
Well, you haven't gigged this year, have you? Or have you gigged once or something?
Four times at MacFest.
Wow.
I've got so much done.
I tell you what,
it's just amazing. I'm literally just ticking off my dreams. I'm just like, Dan. It's amazing. If I have a gig, I've got a gig coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And it's ruined the rest of my year. That's all I can think about. Creativity is ground to a standstill. I'm now like a rabbit in headlights, just thinking, oh my God, I've got to do a fucking gig. Absolutely.
It's so weird, isn't it? Going back to it. Do you know what? Because I gigged for 8 years or 9 years or whatever, and then I had some time off. I'd forgotten what it was like to have your evenings.
Right.
So I've like got now used to having my evenings. So it's now adapting back to not having my evenings. And now it's difficult.
Yeah. Well, you're a dad now.
I'm a dad now, yeah. Luckily, the baby's asleep. But I'm missing the one bit of the day when I get to relax.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Fucking hell.
Oh, yeah, so you don't... Yeah, it's all day then, isn't it? You're going to have...
I'm up at six, baby in the day.
Then you go
then
out.
Put the baby to bed, and then you're like, right, off to work. Off to unpaid work as I'm trying material out.
Oh, my God.
Oh, woe is me.
It's good being busy, though, right?
Yeah, good being busy.
And what stage are you at now? What do you have?
I have, to talk comedian to comedian, stuff that is good in a situation where they know you're doing new material, but the moment you're thrust into a gig where you're on with people who are doing proper stuff, you feel out of your depth. Mm. Does that make sense? So I've got a charity gig tonight. And I don't feel I'm going to... If I do my new material, I'm going to be the worst person on the bill.
Sure. Right. But, you're just
but if I went
to
a new material now, I'd be one of the good people on the bill, if
sure,
that makes
but
sense.
You're just going to have to suck it up and just do charity gigs to get to... You know, charity gigs are just like... If you're angry at a charity gig, you're a cunt.
I'm not angry at the charity gig.
Not you. If the audience go to a charity gig, it's kind of like...
Oh, right, yeah.
We've had to put on a show so that you will donate money to charity. That's how much of a cunt you are. Charity is kind of like, oh, do you know what? I'm going to give this because I believe in this cause. This is like, I'm only doing it if I get 2 hours of top-notch entertainment. And if anything kind of falls below top-notch, then I'm going to be fucking pissed off. Tell you what, mate, you are shit tonight. You are half as good as Jack D. And you go, oh, right, well, fucking, I think you've come into this with the wrong attitude.
This doesn't sound much like a generic story. It feels like it's...
I've done comic relief, mate. I've been slagged off by Piers Morgan. Fucking, yeah, what more do you want? 3 hours of free telly, you can. Also, I suppose, because before August we had loads of people coming on talking about their Edinburgh shows. Is it different... I wrote my tour in 2 weeks on stage. Ooh. So I did Edinburgh Work in Progress last year. Had 2 weeks booked, and at the beginning of the 2 weeks, I didn't have anything except for like notes, remember that anecdote. And by about half, your instinct for survival sort of kicks in about halfway through the first week, going, I hate dying. so then you go home and you go, right, what's this fucking show going to be? I'm doing. My fourth Fuckfest gig this year.
Your fourth what, sorry?
Fuckfest. You need to explain what it is.
I do a Christmas charity gig called Fuckfest.
Right.
And this is the fourth one. So 5 years ago, I did. I was filming Uncle, and we booked in a 2 week run of Christmas shows at the Soho Theatre.
Yes. Right?
And what happened was I had Uncle was going to finish, and then I'd have a week to write this Christmas show, and then I'd do 2 weeks of Christmas shows, right? And it was Christmas shows. You go, this will be fun, right? It's going to be fun, right? What happened was Uncle overran filming by a week, right? So they extended by a week. So I had a weekend to write.
I remember you came on the XFM show the day after Uncle had finished.
Oh, right,
And you looked like a ghost when you walked in.
It was my first TV show for that long.
Mm.
And
you were in every scene or most of the
weeks.
Scenes?
Yeah, I was in every day. I had one half day off when we were filming. But I wasn't anticipating I'd be that tired. And so you'd have the weekend off. I think I had the Saturday off, and on the Sunday I wrote the show, did a preview in the evening. And then on the Monday I did the 2 week run. And fuck me, it was. the 2 week run included Black Friday. Oh. It was the worst fucking experience I ever had doing a thing. Because I would work my fucking bollocks off every fucking night to get it to a point where by the end of it, it was like as good as like an Edinburgh show. But 3 days in, the third day was kind of like was the best it had gone, and then I had mince pies spat out all over the floor, and there was Advocar everywhere, and it was a fucking mess. And as the audience had left, I was on my hands and knees, sort of like cleaning up the stage at the end of the gig, right? And these two guys had waited around after the gig, and they came up to me and they said, "Oh, I've seen you off 8 out of 10 cats. Me and my mate came to see you. You were shit tonight." And I'm like on my hands and knees. And I was literally going, that was the best it's ever gone. So now I do this charity thing where it's just like, it's for charity. If you don't like it, then fuck off. And it's just, you know, it's just literally comedians having a... But yeah, it's difficult. But
do you think yours will still come together in the last couple of weeks?
It's good. Wait, what? Because I've got such a long deadline, you think I'm not pushing it? Yeah, I think that's the problem, isn't it? You can't.
The longer you have, then the less you use it. That's what
exactly.
I,
the work.
I use all of mine. So. So how do you find the difference between writing like an Edinburgh show and. When's the last time you did like a full run at Edinburgh?
2000 and. What's the year? 11, 12, 13? 13.
2013. Wow. So it's 5 years. And you've done another big tour in between.
I did
one
more after that that I didn't do in Edinburgh. So I finished that in 2016. So I've had a year and a half off. No, 2 years. What year are we in?
2018.
A year and a half about off. So it's quite weird to go back. It's still the same thing I have where I just. You're looking to reach that time that you know is an adequate amount of time for the show to go.
Yeah, sure.
And you're like, once I reach that, I can relax. But
yes,
now,
yeah.
Now it's just like, you think of something, you think, that's going to be 2 minutes, isn't it? That's going to tick off another 2 minutes.
I
do sums in my head as well. Like, if I can come up with 1 minute a week for the next year.
Oh, yeah, sure, right.
Yeah.
But that's not, unless like how an accountant would write a show.
I can't judge. I look at my notes on my end and or on my notepad or whatever just before I go on stage and I'm just like, that is either 3 minutes or an hour and a half. I've got no idea.
This is the first one I've written on computer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Computer.
And do you know when you start and they say, you should listen back to your gigs? It's really helpful. Mm. I've recorded my gigs for 10 years. I listened to a gig for the first time the other day and it was really helpful.
Yeah, sure.
I've never actually listened to them before.
Really?
I've always recorded them.
I've got hours and hours and hours. I've had to get new phones because I've got so many gigs saved. Yeah.
I feel like I've done it so often I'm now used to how awful my voice sounds.
Yeah.
I've got no, like, it almost feels like I should gain more shame about it. Because I feel like, I'm totally used to it. That's how I sound.
Just enjoying a coffee and listening to yourself.
I'm always terrified that someone will, like, I'll pull the lead out and he'll keep playing. And he goes, this guy listening to his own show. Only thing worth listening to.
I wouldn't have written the stuff if I didn't think I was the best. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't have the confidence to perform this material if I didn't think it was the best. What's the point in looking to anyone else? That's how I feel about my music.
Susie Ruffle said to me that I think she had it like... It got saved onto her iTunes or something, and she had it on
Shuffle.
And it came on while she had someone around, like, in songs.
It's either your own voice that comes up on Shuffle or Cunt and the Gang. And then you're like, no! Don't go in the bathroom! Press stop on the iPlayer! It's lovely stuff.
Yeah.
So you've got last leg next week again.
Next week, we're back.
And that runs for how many weeks?
Christmas.
Oh, wow.
We're doing a New Year's one as well, which will be...
Sound absolutely haunted by it.
The New Year's one, I'm quite nervous about. Cause
how come? What's...
It's 2 hours. It's like a film.
Yeah.
That's like this.
That's like this, man. This is
the first one we've done for 2 hours.
Oh, you know when they say in a marathon after about mile 21 you feel the burn? I reckon an hour and a half so you feel the burn.
Well, we're an hour and 19 into it, Josh. And
you
I'm
guys,
feeling
you
it pretty
guys
hard.
Could throw to music. We can't do that. We've got ads, I suppose.
Yeah, you do have, but you can't do it at will. I think it's time for another ad break.
It'd be good if you could.
Yeah, I need to compare anecdotes.
I need a piss. Here's some ads.
It's good.
No, it'll be fun. I think
the last leg's become like an iron horse, isn't it? Of Channel 4. It's like it's become like a big huge show. It's never. It seems to rarely be off, right?
Yeah, it's quite weird, isn't it? It started as just a Paralympic thing. But it's we do 30 a year.
Wow. It's not like you have a series, though, is it? Is it?
We do. Yeah, we do. We do have 10. They do them in blocks of 10, but it all kind of is either on.
I just feel
not.
Like it's just always.
It's
on.
Not like. Have you seen the new series of the last?
I'm only on series 4 at the minute, so don't tell me how it ends.
I suppose it's sort of like the closest we've got to something like the Tonight Show.
Yeah, it feels like that now, right? It's become almost like a late night chat show.
That's what you want. Like, I tell you what happens is you. Because it's tiring to do, obviously.
Right.
It's like a job. So when you get to the end of the 10 weeks, you're like, oh, great, a rest. And then a funny news story happens, and you're like, I wish.
Oh, you wish you were
like,
on air.
Like, you know those two Russian guys.
I know exactly how you feel.
Claiming the soul's
breathing. I used to do news review, so I know exactly. How
it comes up a lot here, doesn't it?
Didn't you used to write. You didn't used to write news review.
I wrote me and my brother wrote a few sketches for it. Yeah.
You did, yeah.
Is it still going?
I've no idea, mate.
You gotta resubmit some stuff.
No. When the last leg's not on, of course, I need an outlet.
But right, so the story will come on about Russians.
No, you know that those two Russian guys saying were going on holiday to Salisbury.
Yes.
And you're just like, we've spent fucking 6 weeks talking about Brexit. This is a gift. Do you not get to do?
So since we've last been on,
yeah, we've tried that before, and it just sounds like so stale. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, like previously.
It's when stand-ups come out and go, "Phew, Christmas is coming in 4 months, isn't it?" And they do their Christmas joke or something. You go,
"Do you remember it was Christmas 5 weeks ago?"
Yeah. Who's doing Dry January 4 months ago?
Yeah, I love it. I don't think I have a problem with doing any of that.
I've got Christmas material, yeah.
You got to throw it in.
No, I'm not going to do it now. But I mean, like, it is interesting. Like, do you think you can get away with it round the year, Christmas material?
No, it feels too. It depends what it's.
My gigs that are coming up are Christmas gigs, so I guess
your material?
We will see. We'll see how far I can go for the rest of next year doing Christmas stuff. Do you write Christmas material every year, or do you just?
I've not written Christmas material specific for Christmas. I just ended up writing some stuff about Christmas.
I would have thought that everyone has a sort of Christmas set.
I don't really.
You just think that the fact that you're there is a gift enough.
I wrote something last year about Movember and all those things, and that seemed to keep me going into Christmas.
Oh yeah, sure. Movember. Yeah, of course. So have you just got a few pillars throughout the year? Movember, bit on Valentine's Day, bit on May Day.
But that's almost the only time I've been able to get away with it.
Actually,
normally,
saying all this out loud, it seems unrealistic and judgmental of an audience to expect you to tailor your material for specific times of the year.
Oh, I don't usually. It's only when you happen to come up with something, and then it just annoyed me because my stuff's not particularly clubby or anything, and it suddenly felt like I'd just written something that felt like, well, this works, and then I felt bad that I couldn't do it.
What you could do? You could do, like, because you've got a bit on Movember. I reckon if you did got a bit on charity stuff at the top.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Then you could just segue into the Movember stuff. And I don't think anyone would go, whoa, 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 it's March, mate.
Thank you very much. Charity
stuff, why would you? You just cut the Movember material. No one.
Nah, it's sort of quite specific.
Yeah, but the only reason why the Movember material is good is because you do it around Movember and people think, bloody hell, he's just thought of that. It's not good because it's like improv. It's like, it's good because you go, oh, wow, they've just thought of that.
Yeah.
It's not good because they've written it down, because if they had, it would be better.
No, I wonder. I think you might be able to get away with it if you were talking about something else and they're like, well, like Movember. Oh.
Talking about Movember.
David Trent has a Movember joke.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Oh man, I should compare notes. There can't be that much in it.
It's called No Fat. That's his joke.
Seems inappropriate, doesn't it?
It was on
the radio.
It was his joke.
Sorry, mate, I burnt that for you.
he sort of burnt
that well, though.
Two people laughed in the studio.
He burnt it for himself, didn't he? He did it. You know, he did it in his last talk. It's good. Should we play a song and then we'll do another thing? This is going to be what we're going to do now is we're going to play. Let me just get ready. We're going to play your.
I love this. Let's get the mouse out again.
This is your favourite song, Josh. We're going to play your favourite song. Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was just a choice.
Nah, only joking. This is the song that you've chosen.
To the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide. Well, stop and a turn, and I go for a ride. Till I get to the bottom, and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But do you, don't you want me to love you? I'm coming down fast, but I'm miles above you. Tell me, come on, tell me the answer.
Hello, we're back. I got blisters
on my fingers.
I knew that was the one. Hello, how you doing?
Good.
Are we back?
We're back.
Helter Skelter by the Beatles.
We're just discussing what an awful choice that was for radio.
Yeah,
I apologise.
You never know when it's in or end and when it's in. When you listen to that song, you are listening to the birth of heavy metal.
Exactly, that's why I chose it. Do you know why I chose it?
Why?
Because...
Big Manson family fan?
Because I know that you're a fan of the Beatles.
Yeah.
I know that you're a fan of heavy metal.
This is true.
So I thought it would be the perfect choice for the show.
Oh, what a lovely, nice. Thoughtful choice.
How selfless as well.
Well, no, I like it as well.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay. Good news, bad news. I had to do a karaoke thing once. It was either Beatles or Rolling Stones songs for charity.
Yeah. And, so you can be as shit as you want.
I was absolutely shit. I sang Oasis. I sang that for that, I think.
It's a good choice.
It's really, yes.
A lot of those Beatles ones for karaoke are a bit too kind of not bombastic enough, I don't think.
Yes.
Well, I don't know, Eleanor Rigby.
Cheer people up, but yeah.
Cheer people up. Seventh birthday party, it was.
Well, I can't bear things that when they have like earnest songs on karaoke things.
Ooh,
you go, yeah. Oh, God. Ooh.
What's your karaoke song?
I know, I'd sort of try and avoid it, really. I'd probably do something like The Candyman. Or something silly.
I think that's a good call.
Yeah, I was doing karaoke once in a pub. And
best place.
And, and just before we went on, we were going to do American Pie, right?
Yeah.
And just me and two guys, two of my mates at uni. Can't remember who it was. Yeah. So it was like me and a girl and a guy, and we went around all the student unions at the time. We were called two girls and a guy, two guys and a girl. It was Friday night, it was student union. We were going to do. It was the pub around the corner from the student union. We were going to do karaoke, and we get up to the top of the karaoke, and just as we were about to do our song, American Pie. the guy that was running the karaoke made an announcement, and he just said, I just want to say that one of the regulars that normally drank here every week for the last 10 years, he died recently, and I think we should all just have a minute silence.
Oh my word.
And we were stood up there going, and then he stopped at that. He goes, we're just going to have a minute silence. So everyone stood up to nerd a minute silence. And I just was just like, we're going to sing American Pie. We're going to sing This Will Be the Day That I Die. Right? Over and over again. And I turned around to the guy that was running the karaoke. And I said, I just don't think this song. I don't think this song is appropriate. So I think that maybe we should pick another song. And he goes, all right, have you got any other songs? And the guy I was up there with, he said, how about Ghostbusters?
And the karaoke guy said, yep, because everyone requests Ghostbusters. So he just pressed play before we even had a chance to fucking question it. And then we're up there. Or maybe it was the other way around. Maybe it was Ghostbusters. And then we were singing American Pie. And we got to the bit, we're going, this will be the day that I die. That was how it went. And
not only is he dead, but these guys even hate ghosts. Does he get no peace?
Great stuff. But you're icon is your favourite popular culture icon is Paul McCartney, right?
I thought I'd choose Paul McCartney. Yes, I don't have a definitive answer to that. Like, I suppose my favourite ever musician would be Damon Albarn or David Bowie.
I am surprised that you didn't.
I think Paul McCartney's a more interesting cultural icon than Damon Albarn. I think Damon Albarn is a musician primarily, but I don't think Albarn would in any way kind of claim to have changed culture in the way that Paul McCartney has.
He has done his little fair share.
He'd certainly be in my top three, but I chose Paul McCartney because I think the impact of the Beatles was so huge. And I do think, like, whenever I read about, like, 1963 to 1970 and the Beatles, I don't think there's... It just blows my mind that time actually happened.
They really
did. And they lived through that. And everything changed that much in 7 years. That's less time than I've been a stand-up.
You've had a similar...
I'm not going to lie. I'm turning out the same old shit.
So this next tour is your Sergeant Pepper, isn't it? That's what they're saying.
The reason I've chosen Paul McCartney as well is I do think he gets a bad rep because he is in essence a man in his 70s and people have a go at him for being uncool.
Yeah.
And I don't, obviously, I'm not saying John, you don't know what John Lennon would be up to.
Who would know what could be up to now?
But has Paul McCartney ever been cool? I don't think he has he?
In the 60s, Paul McCartney was the more avant-garde Beatle.
As soon as the 60s ended,
and
he wasn't the Beatles.
No, but of the Beatles, Paul McCartney was the one that moved them in an avant-garde direction.
And he got John into lots of stuff,
but
didn't he?
Since the Beatles, Wings.
I think that first McCartney album, McCartney 2, they are quite kind of odd experimental albums, aren't they? Temporary Secretary.
I don't
secretary
know how often I sit down and listen to Paul McCartney's solo work.
I've got a very similar... I really like him, I think, and I've got a real soft spot for him. And also, as someone who... My thing about Paul McCartney is almost that Paul McCartney acts like he was never in the Beatles. And that's the thing I find fascinating about him, is that he just does that thing, goes, hey, we're just a great little rock and roll band.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it was the Beatles, though. It wasn't like... it wasn't me, the guy, and the other guy from karaoke. Yeah. It was the Beatles.
Yeah.
Goes, yeah, well, that's it, which was, And he just... I think he almost plays it down. And I think perhaps because... Paul McCartney doesn't have that perspective that everyone else has.
Yeah.
Because to him, it's just the band he was in.
I think there is a certain amount of the fact that he is playing down the Beatles because he has, lived another 50 years on top of them.
Yeah,
oh, for sure.
Me and Trent, when we were on tour, were listening to the Bruce Dickinson autobiography. Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he talks for fucking, it's a long book, and he talks for about 19 chapters before he even mentions Iron Maiden. And when he does, he mentions it in passing, and he spends just as long talking about his solo career.
Oh,
and
man,
goes,
no.
This is crazy. This is absolutely insane. And I think there is a certain amount of... he's an egomaniac. And I'm not saying Paul McCartney doesn't have an ego, but Bruce Dickinson needs medical attention.
I want to hear the book now.
The book is fucking... I mean, David Trent, threatened to crash the car every time we put it on audio.
radio, which, because it, and we'd got to a point when we've devoted so much of our lives to this point, it would be a sin not to finish the book.
But and is he reading it personally?
Yeah, he said. Oh, I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. It's like no, but it is. It's absolutely astonishing, and fucking hell. But it's even better. Oh, man, oh. It's well worth listening to Bruce Dickinson read out his own autobiography. He doesn't mention. There's a whole portion of the book where he battles cancer, and he must have had a lot of support. He goes through the entire book without mentioning his wife or kids once, right? Like, he doesn't mention anyone other than himself, and you just like go, wow. He mentions the other band members of Iron Maiden as if they were holding him back, and as if they were a bunch of clowns on stage, and you're going, well, I wanted to do the splits, but these clowns got in my way.
Could I not an expert on Iron Maiden.
Me neither.
How did it end, Iron Maiden? Like, is it all?
They're still around.
So he's still in Iron Maiden?
Yeah, but he's like a gun for hire. He considers it the fact that Iron Maiden were a band
before. But he's
before
still
him.
Having to work with these people.
He wasn't the original he wasn't the original singer. There was another singer, and then he came along and saved Iron Maiden.
Right.
And so he can... But he's got his solo career, he's got his planes, he's got his... because he's a pilot, and he's an Olympic standard fencer. He's all these things.
I think in an autobiography of a famous person, I want a maximum of 6 pages on the childhood. Like, I've got no interest in the childhood.
Yeah. And they might as well
get famous.
That.
Get famous.
Yeah.
If you've
done funny things like those, I really love Danny Baker's books where he's
they're great
because it's
they're
like great. Stories yeah, about yeah. when he's a kid and funny things that happened when he's and yeah. in fact it became a sitcom, didn't it?
Sure. But what you don't want is like. And my mum made the great lunchbox I used to have.
Yeah, only say stuff when you've got something to say.
Yeah, yeah. Do your anecdotes and then get to...
top 10 anecdotes and then you're famous.
Yeah.
But yeah, Bruce Dickinson's is that. It's like navel-gazing. And also like going into a war zone to do a gig, and he just talks about it like he is in the military.
Would you enjoy writing an autobiography?
I don't know. But what you said, Jack D's autobiography is really great.
I've not read Jack D's.
It's good. It's like, let's just say it's 250 pages, and it takes about 50 pages for him to stop writing jokes, right?
Right.
And so it's like very kind of like gaggy, like set up punchline for the first... I imagine he wrote it in order.
Yeah.
So it's like you can feel him getting used to it for the first... And then the rest of it is kind of like... just really great. It's about it takes you all the way up to him making it, and so you don't get any of the fame stuff. You don't get any.
Oh, really?
It takes him all the way up to the point where he's almost like decided to be a professional comedian.
Do you think he'll do a sequel of?
I think that it leaves it open for a sequel, but I mean, it's really nice. It comes across as. It sort of like drops the persona of being a comedian.
Are you worried about when he gets onto Josh?
No, I was thinking. Do you know? I was thinking that I've just read Romesh's book. Oh, Romesh has just done autobiography, and I got it, and I was reading it over the weekend.
Have you read it all?
Yes. It's really good.
How long?
It flies by.
Sure.
It's hardback, so does that mean it's more pages? It's about 250 pages.
He sent a copy to my agent.
It's great.
And I've got to pick it up later.
Yeah, it's really good.
But I'm not looking forward to it, really. I've just worked with him this year. And
do you not want to see if your name's in the back?
I've had a bit much. I don't think I have been mentioned. I don't think I will be. I would have made the book.
It didn't get to that point. It didn't.
Is Sean in it?
Yes, because he supports Sean on tour.
Right, yeah. Because he said he had to ask permission about... He had to ask Sean whether he could use his name in the book. And this was one of the conversations. Just had to, and then we were all like going, what about us, Rom?
permission granted, Romesh. But that's great. It's such a good book. And it's really funny. And do you know what? It dwells on... comedy books, you want them to dwell on bad gigs. Do you know what I mean? You don't want, and then I smashed it, and then I had this, and then it... You know, he's funny and self-effacing.
Guess
there's
that's
nothing.
Me out of an autobiography. Fucking... No, it is annoying. Well, there's a Steve Martin autobiography, which is kind of like almost like a textbook, as well as
an autobiography.
Oh, that's a brilliant one. Yeah,
that's really Born to Stand.
Frank Skinner's is great.
Frank Skinner's
great. First one is amazing, and then his second one is basically the, by the way, mate, you're in the book situation, isn't it?
What do you mean?
Well, his assistant gets absolutely roasted in it.
Who does?
His assistant.
Oh, his tour manager.
That's a great book for someone who's going back with no material, isn't it? That has all
that's
that stuff.
There's an amazing bit in that book where he talks about, so he's on tour with his tour manager and they get into their hotel and he's like, this is quite a small hotel room they've given me, and then they go around for like breakfast and the tour manager's like, I've got quite a big room. And then he just says, we didn't look each other in the eyes as we walked past each other with our stuff in the hallway swapping rooms. But Skinner's so honest. Like, that first autobiography, really honest.
Well, when we all started out, there was kind of like, I don't know, when Born Sending Out came out, maybe 2009? But
no, it was about when I started, because I remember reading it.
What's this, the first one?
Steve Martin.
But there was kind of like, there was the first Frank Skinner book, there was the Steve Martin book, and, I don't know, another book. those were the ones that every comedian, no matter what standard, would kind of like go, well, these are the ones I've got on my bookshelf.
Yeah. Frank Skinner's is grim as well, but it's also, it's like, so every funny. Line of it is funny.
There's a bit that stayed with me forever. About shaving his girlfriend's head? Yeah. He talks about shaving his girlfriend. I know, it's his wife, his first wife. And she used to shave her head, and he said he was shaving her head with a Bic. And he caught a mole. And he said, I don't know if you've ever peeled a potato. And that has like stuck with me. So whenever I think of that book, that's the first image that comes into my head.
Frank Skinner is one of those people, I think, who does just drop the funniest kind of lines on things that you'll never hear again. They will think, he really is one of my favourites, I think, Frank Skinner.
Great at analogies.
Yes, yeah.
When he talks about, actually, I'm not going to talk about that.
You don't want to burn Frank's material.
Is that what? That's what I don't know. Is that inappropriate to do?
I don't know if it's still appropriate because it was from the 90s. So let's move on.
My favourite thing he ever said, which I'll fully attribute to Frank Skinner, was that he said, "I always find it weird that the Elephant Man."
That's what I was going
to
say.
Oh well.
Yeah. Come on.
He says, "I always find it weird that the Elephant Man is called the Elephant Man because he doesn't really look like an elephant. I think he should be called the Stem Ginger Man." And I remember thinking, that's one of my favourite jokes. I think about it all the time.
He's really good.
And he just dropped it in a thing. And I remember also once seeing him, again, this is awful, but it's not like it's his, he just does it once on a TV thing, doesn't he? He was on They Think It's All Over, and there was a story that week about someone who'd brought their dad's ashes to a match. And they weren't allowed to put it in the urn because they said, "Oh, you can't scatter your ashes at the ground anymore." So a guy tried to smuggle it in like a Coke bottle, and he took it into his football match so he could like surreptitiously scatter these ashes. And he goes, and Frank Skinner said, "Oh, that's awful, isn't it? It's coming to something when you can't take a bottle of pop to a match."
Stuck with you for 20 years, that. Yes. The thought still that you watch, they think it's all over, is what really surprises me the most.
I think I would have watched anything.
That Birmingham NEC gig that he did as well, that was like a real kind of, because I was I did a gig with him downstairs at the King's Head, and it was my turn to go on, and just before I went on they said, "Oh, I was just going to bring on Frank Skinner to do 5 minutes." And this is like, I just started.
Yeah.
"I was just going to bring Frank Skinner out to do like 5 minutes of new material." And I was like, fuck. And there wasn't an ad break, there wasn't an interval in between. It was him and then me, and it was like a lineup of 10 people as well. And so he went on and didn't do great, new material. And then I went on and smashed it. And I was just like, I'm better than Frank. I was like four gigs in and I was just like, oh, wow, I've learnt it.
This is it.
And then I saw the material that he did on the Birmingham NEC gig. And it's one of my favourite routines where he's texted a girl, but she hasn't texted him back straight away, and he's gone on a flight of fancy about all of the things it could have been. And the thing about that's amazing about that NEC gig is how intimate he makes it. I think that when we started out, and I used to just watch as many stand-up gigs as possible, you kind of like, you're trying to work out what the secret is.
Yeah.
And I think maybe if I... there's that Lee Mack, the Green DVD that he did, mm-hmm. Lee Mack Live, where he's on stage for like the first 10 minutes going, oh, you've got a hat. And then he does a bit of material about his hat. He goes, you're wearing glasses. And he does a bit of And I'm just thinking, bloody hell, he's just doing all that. And then you go, hang on a minute, every gig that he ever did, there was always someone with a hat and always someone with glasses. But like when you first start out, you go, that's like a magic trick.
Yeah.
And then when you work out later, oh, there's always going to be someone with glasses at a gig. But with the Frank Skinner thing, he kind of like, he picks a guy on the front row, and then what is it? That's a 10,000 seater, is it? 15,000 seater?
Yeah, I don't know, yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah.
And then, so there's a guy, he picks a guy on the front row, and he picks a woman on the third row, and he just talks to them.
Yeah.
And then the whole gig goes from this huge arena into kind of like this intimate, it, almost like the size of the King's Head, where he's just having like a chat with these two people. And you just think that is craft. I mean, you can say a lot about him as a joke writer, and he's a great joke writer, but also he had the craft as well.
I did a gig with you, Frank Josh, Skinner. That just reminded me of. There was a new material gig that was one of Richard Sandlin's gigs, and it was one of those things where it was quite an all-star lineup, and I think it might even have been Alan Carr was on, and it was all like he'd sort of pulled in lots of favors and lots of big acts on, and we were on, Stuart Lee was on, and it had just been everyone basically who was
bizarre lineup.
It was quite odd, but it was all quite big act. I think you might even have come from another gig and got there, and when you got there you said, oh, who's been on so far, and I was like listing them, and it was all big names, and then because they'd all asked to go on early because they want to go home, and it was me and you left. And I remember like almost like flipping a coin to go, I mean, who's gonna do this? And I remember you saying, and it has ended up like it was me, I had to go on next. I went, oh God, I've got to go on and follow these. And then I remember you saying to me, tell them, just go on and say, I've just come from another gig. Anyone good been on? But it worked. It worked.
Did it work?
It worked, yeah.
Oh,
thank you very much.
No worries. I've got no memory of that gig.
It was in that pub. Riding House Street. What was that pub? Green Man?
Yeah.
It was in that.
Green Man up there? That's like you could fit 20 people in
it
there.
It was a mad gig. It was
it a perfect movie?
No, it was like a new material night. But it like suddenly, it was like all, I think he only did it a couple of times, but it always seemed to be like massive names or what felt like massive names at the time anyway.
Anyway, the point I was making is that I think that Paul McCartney hides his ego a little bit more than Bruce Dickinson.
It won't help Paul McCartney that we've spent 2 minutes on him and 8 minutes on Frank Skinner.
we've got 11 minutes left.
Could I change my choice to Frank Skinner?
So what is your favourite TV show growing up?
Growing up, so this is tough, particularly when you're dealing with Nathaniel, because there's I was really into TV as a kid.
Yeah.
It's not like, not close to, I'd say...
I think I'm not like you.
Well, no, I'd say close to you. Like, I watched everything.
Yeah, me too.
I've chosen Gladiators because it had a real impact on me. Not as a human being.
But that's why you're now a bodybuilder.
Sort of impact like a giant cotton wool bag.
No, in terms of being a fan of things as a child, I just remember like really, really being into it. Like appointment television, as they would say now.
I think that throughout maybe the 80s and the 90s, ITV absolutely smashed Saturday nights.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They had Knight Rider, A-Team, Baywatch, Gladiators.
And then they had
You've
all
Been
this.
Framed.
Yes.
Can I just add You Bet into
you
the
bet. Oh,
You Bet.
You.
Catchphrase. I mean, fucking hell. ITV absolutely smashed
I'd very
it.
Rarely, I'd watch, and that, I'd watch on BBC, I'd watch Noel's House Party. I remember watching that. But
Big Break.
Big Break. Isn't it astonishing that Big Break happened?
Big Break.
That's a quiz show about snooker hosted by
Davidson.
Jim Davidson. I was about
Beverly Hills 90210, we're being
Beverly
told.
Hills 90210. Yeah, it was
a golden age.
It was a golden age for Saturday Night TV. And I remember, I vividly remember seeing the listings for Gladiators. And I thought, and it was like, members of the public take on, special bodybuilding athletes who are gladiators. And I remember thinking, that's going to be rubbish because they're going to get destroyed. Now, I watched the first episode. I was like, this is
hooked.
The, I bought the soundtrack cassette for Gladiators, which had
what was on it? Okay.
The Power, which was Jet's theme tune.
Yes,
like that.
Yes, of course.
We were all in love with Jet, right?
Yeah, I met Jet last year, Diane Udall.
Oh, yeah,
and she was lovely.
She's a therapist now, isn't she?
Yes, yeah. That's not how I met her. I wouldn't be able to go for therapy with Jet because too many of my issues resolve around her.
Well, that sounds like one of those shows Alan Partridge would pitch.
Yeah, therapy with Jet. I loved... what else was on the CD? The tape. Boys Are Back in Town.
Yeah.
Was that for all of the guys when they...
I think they'd run out, yeah.
Yeah.
What was Wolf? Wild Thing.
Wild Thing, yes.
Amazing.
The theme tune, which was extended with more verses.
Oh, yeah. I love an extra verse. Yeah.
Did it have a theme tune?
Can You Feel the Power of the Gladiators?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Can
you get that for... Can you find the song?
It's quite good. I watched it recently. It was on Challenge.
Oh, yeah.
And what you don't realise is how empty the Birmingham NEC was and how tightly
Birmingham
cropped.
Birmingham NEC, that fan club.
How tightly cropped the shots were of the crowd. So there'd be about six people and they would cut to a wide and you're like, there's loads of empty seats.
Oh, right. Did people not go and see it filmed then?
Well, I think people did, but it's 10,000 seats, you know.
They probably just say, just turn up if you want to. Watch Gladiators.
But it might have been like season one when it hadn't really caught on.
Yeah, maybe it was. Yeah. But I think you're going to struggle to get 10,000
But you still randomly in conversation get people saying, Gladiators, are you ready?
Yeah, I mean, that catchphrase, I'd be interested to know, like, what has happened to John Anderson. In fact, I probably wouldn't be interested to know. but, like, it's... He's literally just a man defined by catchphrase.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And so we had a couple of gladiators on the last leg for a sketch. And one of them told me, this is a bit of inside.
Oh, also, go on.
I'm sure it's fine because it's 20 years on. That if someone was winning by too much on the Eliminator, they'd speed up the travelator.
Wow. That is good gossip.
Good goss?
That's not fair.
it absolutely isn't.
That's. I mean, the gladiators were a bunch of cheating bullies. this is exactly the reason why I didn't sign up to compete.
If they did a Celebrity Gladiators and offered you the chance, would you do it?
No.
I'd like to have a go in an atmosphere, but maybe in the... privacy of my
Would you
own
like
home.
It untelevised?
Yeah.
Untelevised.
It's a bit like Total Wipeout. I'd love to have a go on that untelevised, but I never want to do it televised.
It would be pointless of me doing it. It's the exact reason why they've got Danny John Jules to do Celebrity Come Dancing. What's it called? Strictly Come Dancing?
Yeah.
Because you've got to have at least someone that's a competent dancer.
Well, I thought that was cheating, right? I just felt like...
I think getting professional dancer.
Yeah. Is Danny John Jules a professional dancer?
Yeah, he's like a dancer.
Oh, no. It's like Debbie McGee last year.
But it's just like you go, yeah, but you can't just have all, you know, Sean Walsh's that are learning on the job, you know. You've got to have. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I thought it was excellent.
I thought you did a great job.
I thought it was really funny.
I've never watched it before. My mum and dad took me out for dinner, for lunch at about 3, and my mum was just like, your mate Sean's on, are you going to watch it? And I was like, yeah, all right. So she came back around to my flat and we watched it. I didn't know it was fucking 2.5 hours
long.
Oh,
yeah, Jesus, mate. It's like Gandhi.
It's a fucking commitment. It started at 6:15, and at like 7:30, I was like going, this is going on for what? Little did I know, there was still another hour and a bit to go. You think fucking fan club's got long? Fucking hell. Nothing prepares you for Strictly Come Dancing, but he did a really good job.
I thought he was great. I think he'll go... A few weeks. Did you watch it?
No, I've never seen Strictly Come Dancing.
You've never seen Strictly Come Dancing, but you're not even going to watch it because Sean's on.
Maybe. I'll see how far he gets.
Give it a go. Yeah.
I reckon
he did a really good job.
I think he's got the potential to be an edge balls.
I thought, fucking hell. Imagine how fucking nervous you'd be. Like the relief as well, once you've finished the dance and gone, like, you know, you get so nervous you go deaf. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The blood's pounding in your ears, and then you go and like go, oh, and then you finish, and you're just like, everyone's going mental. And so you watched the rest of the show after he'd been on, and he just had this huge fucking smile on his face the whole way through. And
but
you just think, he must
also,
be
so. You get criticised the moment you finish. Mm. So you've got to, like, readjust yourself.
Yes.
But I think that you've got so much adrenaline at you at that point, you're just, like, going... And, like, all you can do is kind of laugh, I suppose.
He was really funny with the judges, which is good. I think he's going to do well. Fingers
so he'll
crossed.
Be popular, though, won't he? So it's a public vote, isn't it?
I think he's got Housewives' favourite written
I think
through,
he's
like a stick
absolutely,
of rock.
That's what I would be thinking.
He's absolutely bringing sexy back.
He is absolutely bringing sexy back.
Right, we've got to play the game. Oh, no, hang on, what's your favourite film?
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Great. Last fan club. I mean, 2 hours, we've still run out of time.
This is Better or Worse, Josh.
Yeah.
Where we have
what
to
do you think? Honestly, she's just told me to do the game now after I've already announced the fucking game.
I've done a special sort of 90s, except for. So you have to. I'm going to give you a name, and you're going to have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before it.
Lovely.
And it's all 90s, except for one from a different era. Ooh. Watch out for it.
Okay.
We've got the music
oh,
next.
Oh, shit, fuck, right, yes. A few extra swears there.
Danny Baker is your first one.
Oh, worse.
Is Danny Baker better, or is Philippa Forrester better or worse than Danny Baker?
Oh, I think she's probably worse.
She is worse. It's yes. quite a high cut. Nah. Jane Middlemiss. Is Jane Middlemiss?
She's worse than Philippa Forrester.
She is worse than
on,
Philippa
Jane
Forrester.
Middlemiss?
She was on the Ozone.
Jane Middlemiss.
She was on the Ozone
oh,
with.
I remember Jane Middlemiss.
Jamie Thigston, but is Jamie Thigston better or worse than Jane Middlemiss?
Oh, that's tough, isn't it? I think Jamie Thigston is better than Jane Middlemiss.
Yeah, let's say better.
He
yes,
did
yes.
that pop thing that Matt Lucas and.
Yes,
yes
exactly.
he did.
He was really good on that.
Zoe Ball. Zoe Ball.
Zoe Ball's brilliant.
Yeah, better than Jamie Thigston.
Yeah. Yes.
Is Wendy Richard better or worse than Zoe Ball?
Who's Wendy Richard? Pauline Fowler?
Yeah.
Oh, I prefer Zoe Ball, so she's
okay.
worse.
Is
Are
Little...
you not buying that?
It's a high card.
Yeah,
card.
Oh, it is, it is, it
yeah.
is. Yeah,
I
that's
love
correct.
Zoe Ball.
Is Little Richard better or worse than Wendy Richard?
I don't know much about Little Richard. Is he the one that married a 13-year-old?
No.
Oh, then higher. Better.
Yeah, he's better. He's better than Wendy Richard. Is Kate Winslet better or worse than Little Richard?
Yeah, better. She's in Eternal Sunshine.
Oh, I'd say worse than Little Richard.
Kate Winslet is worse than Little Richard?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to remember who did...
Little Richard! Is Mr. Blobby better or worse than Kate Winslet?
God.
Kate Winslet's better than Mr. Blobby.
Sure
well.
Is.
Yeah.
Is Neil Morrissey better
card.
Or worse?
It's a high card.
It's a high card.
Is Neil Morrissey better or worse than Mr. Blobby?
Well, I'm going to go better.
Better,
because,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Much better.
Because he's a human being.
That's it. Natalie, have you
That's
got a
it.
Score?
Not just because he's a human being.
Seven!
Seven!
Seven.
Pretty
That's
good.
Pretty good. It's pretty
is that good.
Good. The highest you ever had is 8.
Oh
yeah, you
really
did really
that.
Well.
Done
there,
really
Josh.
Well.
I did
that.
Really well.
That's Jane Middlemiss on there.
You
highlighted the person who wasn't going to be from the 90s, and to be honest, it caused more problems
it
than
did.
Anyone else within it.
I thought Little Richard was the biggest star of all of them. If
no.
I'm honest.
Who did Great Balls of Fire?
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
So what's Little Richard's song?
Good Golly Miss Molly.
Good Golly Miss Molly. And right. the soundtrack to the movie Predator. That's fucking
is that like is that like Simon and Garfunkel doing The Graduate?
thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much
me.
For
it's
coming.
An absolute pleasure.
Thank
Lovely
you to Dana
you.
Ashbrook
I'm
earlier.
Delighted to be the first 2 hour.
To our okay. guest.
Welcome to the clubhouse.
Welcome to the clubhouse. We should, yes, we should do that.
Tell your friends.